most part, I don't think that that will be a problem, but in part, it depends on the way that the issue arises. Let me give you an example. In Hewitt versus Safe, the claim was somebody filed a claim for benefits. Safe Corporation said, well, you don't get benefits because the statute says that you don't get them. The claimant said, well, yeah, but that statute's unconstitutional, so you have to give me the benefits. In effect, the court held that Safe Corporation was not entitled to rely upon the statute to deny benefits because the statute was unconstitutional. Therefore, there was no protection afforded by the statute, and the agency's action was unlawful. In those kinds of situations, and I think that would be the vast majority of situations in which somebody claimed to be relying upon a statute, the action of the defendant that's in court is held to be unlawful. It's unfortunate from the defendant's perspective that they were proceeding in good faith to rely upon an act of the legislature, but you know, that's just the way the cookie crumbles in the litigation game. And I don't think that in most of those instances, defense that I was just doing what the statute said I was supposed to do would be successful.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Hendrickson, I think that that is the kind of occasion on which the enraged agency might very well come to the emergency board and say, this is a general government expense because it is a statute under the general laws of Oregon. The agency ought to be reimbursed for, at least its budget ought not to suffer for a decision that instead was made by the state's policymakers as opposed to the state official or agency. And I assume that's how the risk would be ultimately spread, depending on the richness of the emergency board and the generosity of its members.
Mr. Chairman, back to the Equal Access to Justice Act, I have some vague recollection that there's some law on the question of if Congress didn't appropriate it or whether there were specific funds available to pay it. Do you remember anything more? The word available is...
Mr. Chair, Senator Fadley, I'm not familiar with the case law at the federal level. I know that the argument was raised early on in, I believe it's under 495, maybe under 497, that says from funds available to the agency. The argument was made that that meant that if there was no line item appropriation, then they couldn't recover attorney fees, and that argument was rejected. Our purpose in using that language was not to provide a hook to make that argument, but merely to make it clear that it's the agency's budget from which the funds come and not from the risk management fund.
Well, and if I may add the other point, Senator Fader, as I'm sure you're aware of, a longtime student of Oregon constitutional law, it is illegal to make an expenditure that is not accompanied by an appropriation. And the Constitution dictates some limitations, so presumably what this says is the agency has to go out and find the funds, but it can't necessarily automatically make the expenditure if there's no appropriation, if they're beyond their appropriated funds.
As Rep. Tevye said, would it hurt some eternal plan if we put the word any in front of the funds?
No, I don't. That's not a problem.
Okay.
The question that I don't have an answer to right now is what happens if you have and this is not an unlikely situation. A small border commission at, for example, this point in the biennium is literally out of funds. A judgment is entered against them. They come to the emergency board of the legislature, and the emergency board of the legislature refuses to give them the additional funds to satisfy the judgment. You may, under those circumstances, have a situation in which there is an unenforceable judgment for attorney fees. But that's the only situation that I can foresee.
You might have a dedicated fund agency such as the highway fund where it's federal monies and they could not be expended for the purposes of an attorney fee award. I mean, so theoretically you could have a trust fund source that would not be, quote, available for the purpose of this payment, and then you'd be looking at presumably an emergency board appearance or some other way to find the funds.
We would advise the agency that they have an obligation to seek funds from the emergency board before telling the judgment creditor we don't have the funds available, any funds available to us. They would have to exhaust all of those sources.
If the Hewlett case hadn't been decided, but this was the law, this bill here, would Mr. Hewlett have been able to sue the workers' comp board members and recover attorney fees?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe in Hewitt that the decision went against the workers' comp board, but went against the insurance carrier. That
well,
in that
no,
case, happened
I'm asking if he could, if under this bill here, could he sue the workers' comp board or the, well, let's take a case where it was a state accident insurance fund involved in the case. So my question is, it goes to something we raised earlier, if it turns out there's a statute on the books that were before a court, the court would declare it unconstitutional, but nonetheless it's being enforced by a state agency, to, rather than the direct route that was taken in that case, if this bill becomes law, could an aggrieved person sue the government personnel that were carrying out the legislative program and recover attorney fees?
Yes. If they were successful on their claim against, Mr. Hewitt would have been able to recover attorney fees from Safe Corporation under that situation, assuming that first he prevailed on his claim.
Now that is a decision that the legislature could make. That is, we could decide that we would put in place a law like this and permit a claim to be made, but we could immunize the individual members of the agency from personal liability for attorney fees.
Yes, there would not be personal liability under this bill because Section 4 provides for indemnity. However, let me make the equity case a little stronger for the individual. If Hewitt had not been Hewitt versus Safe, but had been Hewitt versus Liberty Northwest or some other private insurer, the result would have been the same, and under this bill, the private insurer would have been liable to the petitioner for attorney fees. At that point, the equities start to look a little more favorable to the claimant, who says, look, I was just relying in good faith on the act of the legislature. When it's a state agency, then, you know, we tend to think that it's the monolithic state of Oregon and this body and the executive branch and all of us are part of the state, and so we all get stuck with the actions of the state. If it's a private party that is relying upon an act of the legislature and following what the law says they're required to do, and then subsequently determine that that law is unconstitutional, well, I think they have a pretty good argument that equity would not be served by awarding attorney fees against them because of what the legislature did.
And would there be some other example besides workers' comp insurance where that might apply?
The best examples that I have been able to come up with all arise out of the employment context because that's the most common area where discrimination occurs. Could have a statute on the books that in housing or employment or something either mandated or authorized some kind of discriminatory treatment that was challenged. This court would hold that statute is unconstitutional, and some private landlord or employer relied on that statute in order to justify the practice. I can't think of any specific example right offhand.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hankson.
I was just reviewing Mr. Hinkle's letter again. Maybe you have a copy of it. He indicates in the federal law they don't use the language of available funds. They don't have that kind of limitation. Presently, under the state law, if a state agency or any other governmental entity gets a judgment against them, I mean, they just have to pay it like any other creditor, don't they? I mean, because I've read case law, at least in other states, where as long as that there's the power to tax, I mean, they're going to have to go out there and raise that money. I think the same issue came up with the Wooks bonds. If those bondholders had levied eventually on some of those municipal utilities, I don't think you can just immunize yourself from a judgment by saying we don't have any money available.
Well, Senator Henderson, I think the two responses to that question have been made. First is that no agency can make an expenditure without an appropriation. In fact, it's a misdemeanor. It's a crime. And the Constitution doesn't make it a crime, but the statute enacts that provision effectively. So you can't spend beyond your budget without it. The second point is, and I think Mr. Hinkle's letter completely misses the point, is that unless you focus on the agency that's involved, you leave ambiguous or unsettled the question is, out of what fund is this paid? And the very purpose of tailoring the provision the way we did in subsection 4 was to focus the responsibility for paying the judgment on the agency or official belonging to the agency that caused the discrimination.
Okay, so you wouldn't anticipate that it could be used as a defense against paying the judgment that we don't have any money available?
No, and as Mr. Gary's colloquy with Senator Finley revealed, when that argument was raised in oral argument by then Deputy Attorney General Stan Long before the Oregon Supreme Court, that available meant there has to be a line item or it has to be money in the budget for that. That argument was rejected by the court.
With respect to every other potential judgment creditor under this bill other than state agencies, obviously it's not a defense that we don't have money available. The reason that language is used with respect to state agencies is because of the limitations on an agency administrator's authority to cut a check.
Okay, but when the Supreme Court made that decision, there wasn't a statute before it that said funds available.
Yes, there was. Yes. That's
it
language
that is. Did have a statute that said funds available?
Yes. There are. It's contained in other attorney fee provisions like 495 and 497 in Chapter 183. Mr. Chair, the final point that I'd like to make is with reference to subsection 4. This bill, as my discussion with Senator Hendrickson indicates, is intended to provide that a state agency will pick up the tab if a state officer or employee in the course of his duties is guilty of unlawful discrimination. I would like to suggest and request that the committee entertain in concept an amendment that would cross-reference that provision to the indemnity provisions in the Tort Claims Act. Because obviously if a state officer or employee is found guilty of unlawful discrimination in his or her private life, we don't want the state agency to be responsible for picking that up. It has to be action within the course and scope of employment.
And not an intentional.
And not something that is willful or wanton.
Yeah. And I think we wouldn't cover that.
Right.
Our intent is to say that if a person would be entitled to indemnity under the Tort Claims Act, that person should be entitled to indemnity under this provision.
Any other questions? All right, thank you. And will you submit those two suggested amendments you've got to staff, please, immediately? Okay. The other one being, I think you just had two suggestions. One was changing invidious to unlawful, and the one in the last
towards claims
subsection there. Okay, thank you. Now we'll call on, let's see, Sarah Wilson.
Chair, while we're waiting, have the legal minds considered some of the repercussions of the military code bill that we carried on the floor this morning regarding the constitutionality and legislative intent? I'll leave that to you. That was my only comment.
I think that's a reproachful question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sherry Osier, Executive Director of the Oregon Student Lobby. We are supportive of Senate Bill 494, but we do have a problem with subsection 4, especially the things that you have just been discussing, especially the words directly from the funds available to it, meaning the state agency. And let me give you one example that happened just recently that is parallel to this. You may recall, because there was a great deal of publicity just a few months ago, the State Board of Higher Education last December used $900,000 in over-realized tuition funds to pay for legal costs to the state system. Later, a few weeks after that, the emergency board decided to replace that money with general fund dollars. Do you think there is a policy issue here? Should other funds be used for awards under this section? We would think that is not in the best interest of public policy, that such awards should be made strictly from general fund dollars. And I hope we can try to put together an amendment that would take care of that if the committee would be interested. But I hope you would take that into consideration when you're working on this bill in work session.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
Senator Feeley.
Trying to put together an amendment, would you say use general funds first or only general funds or?
Well, what we could do is be very specific and say no fees under the control of the Department of Higher Education pursuant to ORS 351, or we could be more general than that.
All right. I tried the word any out on them, and then I was thinking any funds lawfully available, since there might be some funds that might not be lawfully available, and now you're wanting to pass a law about what's lawfully available, so we're at least thinking in the same general direction. The Attorney General said that if it was federal highway funds, you couldn't use it for attorney's fees. But any funds lawfully available would at least start you down the road of examining whether it was lawful to use them.
And the contractors, too, I'm sure they use
it. It may not get you all the way to the little house you want to be in, but it starts then.
We'll make an attempt.
The road.
Senator Simmons.
I guess it's not only in the state agency, but many, many judgments are uncollectible. And I can prove that. I offer several at the penny on the dollar if anybody wants to buy them. So I think worrying about details of how to collect a judgment from the state is not too productive, because certainly that stands a much better chance of being paid than many judgments against private companies.
Once the agency gets its back up, it will try to figure out a way not to pay it. And that is the history that some of the cases I was talking to Mr. Geary about earlier come from. The U.S. Department of Labor just didn't want to pay. You know, they didn't want it. And so they made it hard to find any money that they could pay with.
So do a lot of other...
They sure do, don't they?
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Steve, you want to?
I'm Stevie Remington, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. And when Mr. Hinkle got word of this hearing and learned that he wasn't able to attend, he had had a letter from Senator Hendrickson asking some questions, and so he responded to her questions in letter form and gave it to me to summarize for a testimony at the hearing. Of course, we took the position last session and still maintain it that we would see no reason for providing attorney's fees for vindication of some rights under the Oregon Constitution and not others. And in his testimony, he cites a number of cases in which he has been personally involved. For instance, the Marks case, a free speech case under the Oregon Constitution, where we would clearly have been entitled to attorney's fees if it had been brought in federal court under the First Amendment, and none were awarded. Church-state cases, and talks about the principal in Darris v. Myers, the private attorney's general theory, and fees have been denied for people who have prevailed on claims of violation of constitutional rights, and we think they ought to cover all of those, and he has proposed an amendment to do that. On page 3 of his testimony, he outlined some specific concerns. And
maybe, could I just add, wait, before Stevie goes on, that first section was obviously a compromise because the original bill did provide for all constitutional claims. The Attorney General, that was one of his objections, and they did want to limit it to discrimination. So that is the first compromise area, and I must say.
And at the bottom of page 2, Mr. Hinkle does note that we would still support it in its present form as a small step in the right direction, but we would like to for you to consider amending it to cover all violations of the Oregon Constitution. He was concerned about the language of the prevailing party, and if you see the sheet attached, he has specific proposed amendments, and he would amend that to apply to a complaining party who prevails on a claim of violation of rights protected by Article 1 of the Constitution or on a claim of unlawful discrimination. Also, at the bottom of Section 1, he thought it was important that you be specific about what is covered in reference to that final judgment, and has proposed some language that would say at the trial court or agency level or on appeal to be sure that it includes all of those things. And subsection and B regarding subsection 2 and what the reasonable rates are, he is concerned that and outlines the case law and proposes an amendment that it be made clear that it shall be a reasonably hour rate at the time the award is made. If you've been 3 years in litigation and have raised your attorney's fees, you are entitled under case law to the rate at which is the market value at the time the award is made. And he discusses the multiplier thing and suggests an amendment that the court may make an upward adjustment in the award of attorney's fees in cases where the complaining party faced a substantial risk of not prevailing or where the complaining party achieved exceptional success. And the reason for this isn't, I don't see it as a windfall for an attorney, but if you go as a private person with a frontier issue on a constitutional right, and that may be extensive research and no good precedents to follow, even in other jurisdictions, a substantial risk that the attorney's not going to get anything because you might fail, you need this kind of incentive in order to find an attorney.
Pardon? It's sort of like the lottery. You've got to encourage them that they may win.
And finally, in sub 3, he has some amendments to say nothing in this subsection 3 precludes a court from making an award under this section against parties who were acting pursuant to a statute that is held by the court to be unconstitutional in whole or in part. He suggested, as Senator Hendrickson pointed out, because of his concerns about the agency being able to claim that it really didn't have the money and use it as a hook for getting out of the judgment, that it be deleted, and I don't know how he would respond to the statements made today by the Department of Justice, and I will probably be asking him to call and let me know on that. I don't know that there's anything else in here that that I need to call attention to. I think his statement is fairly clear.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you. We have Marshall Olmert. Meyer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Marsha Olemiller representing the Women's Rights Coalition. Senate Bill 494, which would require the court to order costs and attorney fees to the successful plaintiff in a discrimination suit, has two purposes: to provide a policy incentive to prevent discrimination and to provide access to courts to those with claims. Constitutional litigation is costly and complex, and when a plaintiff is successful in a case challenging state action as unconstitutional, not only that individual, but also society as a whole benefits. Successful cases in Oregon have overturned statutes granting exclusive fishing rights in navigable waters, prohibiting civil service employees from becoming candidates for public office, and recently statutes which discriminate impermissibly on the basis of gender, which was the Hewitt v. Safe case. I'd like to quote to you from the Oregonian, Friday, August 19th, 1983, discussing the precedent or the preceding bill to this one, Senate Bill 755 from the last session. The article says, however tough Oregon law is on discrimination, it is a little consequence unless some mechanism assures that the law is obeyed. In this society, that task is assigned to lawyers. What this translates to is that the victim of racial or gender discrimination must hire an attorney in order to enforce the law. Take away the attorney and the legal remedy is effectively eliminated. Attorneys cost money. Congress and the President understood that point when they included attorney fee provisions in federal anti-discrimination laws. We would urge you to put such attorney fee provisions into Oregon statute and urge your support of Senate Bill 494. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Thank you, Marcia. All right, that's going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 494. We've got two bills left, but there are no one signed up on Senate Bill 792. Somebody here, though, wants to testify. We'll go to Senate Bill 257. And is Mr. Gary out there, or did he decide to go home?
He's testifying. He's been here the whole time.
Pardon?
He's testifying.
All right. Where's Peter Sandrock? Same thing?
Here you go.
Oh, okay. Oh. All right. Yes, all right, here. Peter, sit down a minute. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to apologize to Representative French. Come on up. I don't have your name on my sign-up sheet, so I'm sorry I didn't. You're here now on 257?
No, Senator, on 792.
Okay, let me back up. 792 is the one where I don't have any witnesses signed up, but you're here to testify on that one.
Yes, Senator, I do apologize.
It's all right.
Another meeting.
I'm kind of a little slow myself right now. So let's go, let's turn to Senate Bill 792 then. And Representative French is here to testify on that.
Yes.
Okay, sir. Go right ahead then.
Thank you, Senator, members of the committee. For the record, I am Representative Ray French from District 59. I come here today wearing two hats, one as the aforementioned state legislator and the other as a landowner who has had his share of trespassers, their disrespect to person, property, and their deliberate damage to land and equipment. In spite of my frustrations and occasional anger, however, I must oppose Senate Bill 792. It would certainly be easy to cite instances of trespass, both from neighbors and myself, where it would seem that the laws are not adequate. Senate Bill 792, however, goes beyond any reasonable limit for penalty for trespass. In Section 1, Subsection 1, that makes possible, in addition to existing penalties, the forfeiture of a motor vehicle or firearm in possession of a trespasser. From experience both as a rancher and with visiting hunters, four-wheel drive pickups are in the area of $14,000 to $18,000. And firearms, as used by big game hunters, cost at least several hundred dollars, and I suggest that that's a conservative estimate. It is my belief that a penalty should fit the crime, and 7 Bill 792 does not do this. The confiscation of a motorized vehicle could result in a fine of upwards of $15,000 goes far beyond this concept. Certainly, I understand the problems of those victims of trespassers. However, a more reasonable approach must be found. This bill would, in my estimation, would result in chaos not only on this problem, but would set a precedent for excessive penalties in other areas as well. It would be my request that 792 either be tabled or no action taken at this time by your committee.
All right. Representative French, I certainly appreciate your being here now, and I want to tell you that once in a while I'd like to have you on the Judiciary Committee when I try to explain to people in the audience that, you know, the answer to every single offense in the world is not to give people life in the penitentiary. The penalty should fit the crime, just like you said here. And I think you're being very reasonable about this, and I'm glad to have your testimony today.
Thank you, sir.
Any questions of Representative Frank? Okay, thanks again, sir.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair.
Counsel.
I'm going to also point out to the committee that this bill applies only to 164.245, which is criminal trespass in the second degree, a Class C misdemeanor. It doesn't, by the language, present language, apply to criminal trespass while in possession of a firearm, which is a Class A misdemeanor. And that would be seem to be the problem that's addressed.
All right. Okay. Thank you. All right. Now let's turn back here to Senate Bill 257. And Pete Sandrock, you were ready to go a minute ago.
Lawyer, somewhere in there, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pete Sandrock representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Bill Gary and I had intended to testify together on this issue. However, I think he's already departed. Some background. When a defendant during a single criminal episode violates several statutes, such as a burglary with intent to commit rape, or injures several victims, such as the drunk driver whose actions result in the death or injury of several people, or the defendant who violates the same statute repeated times against the same victim, when that individual is convicted, it creates a problem for the courts in trying to decide how many judgments can be entered. In other words, the DA can charge as many offenses as appear to exist within the criminal episode. The jury can find the defendant guilty of as many of those offenses as the jury deems appropriate, but the court doesn't know whether to enter multiple judgments and multiple sentences. The courts tell us that they don't know what to do because whether multiple sentences